This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Once upon a time, some people on the left decided it wasn't enough to write for adults. Why not, they thought, write stories for children that embodied the values and aspirations of progressive and radical social movements? Why not get to people while they're young, when they're first developing an understanding of and maybe some opinions about the status quo? What was there to lose and how much indeed could be gained? A new book edited by Julia Mickenberg and Philip Nell explores the world of radical children's literature in great depth. It's entitled Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature, and it's just out from NYU Press. Both editors join me now by phone. Julia Mickenberg is an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's author of Learning from the Left, Children's Literature, the Cold War, and Radical Politics in the United States. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Philip Nell is a professor of English at Kansas State University, where he directs the program in children's literature. His books include The Annotated Cat, Under the Hats of Seuss and His Cats, and J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels, A Reader's Guide. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Julia Mickenberg, let me start with you. What do you see as the mission of this book, Tales for Little Rebels?
Well, I guess I hadn't really thought of it as having a mission, but that's a good question. I guess the first mission of it was really just to get this work out there. I think that this represents a body of work, a tradition of work that has received very little attention that most people don't even know about. We in our introduction, we quote Herb Cole, who had a plea for radical children's literature and was saying, why are there no books that teach children to take collective action, that teach social responsibility, all of these things. And in writing my first book, which looked at radicals who wrote children's literature particularly during the McCarthy period, I had begun to uncover what was really a huge body of literature, and we kind of continued on that path. So I think one of the main missions of it is to just bring that work back to life, but we also hope that it will offer inspiration to a new generation of children and to parents and maybe even to writers who will go out and create more work.
And Phil, what time period did you choose to focus on, and what age group of children in terms of people reading this material?
Well, we focus on the 20th century because we are both 20th centuryists, although there is, of course, children's literature from before the 20th century that would fit into that category. And we deliberately focused on younger readers. We were thinking picture book age readers, grade school readers, because once you get into literature for adolescents, it's all political, and it would be much harder to create an anthology of radical literature for adolescents, because I don't know where you would begin and where you would end. There's just too much of it.
Julia, this book addresses the 20th century, but as Philip said, to put things in context, I guess we need to go back before the 20th century. What can you tell us about the tradition of radicals and progressives creating literature to educate young people before the 20th century?
Sure, and let me just tag on to Phil's comment. We concentrated on stories that were for younger readers, but there are a few stories that are probably more appropriate for older readers, and some that may even have been written for adults that sort of use children's literature forms. And this kind of speaks to our larger mission, which was capturing the range of radical movements in the 20th century. And also to tag on to why the 20th century is, we were concentrating on out-of-print works, but we wanted material that would still feel relevant for young people. So to answer your question about before the 20th century, I think the largest tradition that is not represented in here would be of abolitionist children's literature. Lydia Maria Child was probably the most well-known abolitionist who wrote for children. She edited, a magazine for children called The Slave's Friend, and many of the popular magazines of the time, the 19th century periodicals for children, represented these abolitionist themes. Our book tries to, you know, cover the range from socialism at the early 20th century to communism in the mid-20th century to civil rights and feminism and environmentalism and a range of the range of movements that come in the 60s and 70s.
The book is Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. The two editors join me by phone on Against the Grain. The last voice you heard belongs to Julia Mickenberg, who teaches American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Phil Nell also joins us. He teaches English at Kansas State University. Phil, maybe people who haven't picked up this book and who are just hearing about the topic might think, oh, well, these authors, the authors featured and highlighted in this book, I won't know the names of. I mean, these must not be famous people. These must be sort of radical, marginal writers of their times and ours. Tell us some of the names of some of the more well-known children's book authors who identified as being on the left.
Sure. I mean, those people would be half right and half wrong, because we have certainly people who are less well-known, but people who are quite well-known, like Sid Hoff and Dr. Seuss and Monroe Leaf, Carl Sandburg, Langston Hughes, Julius Lester, Walt Kelly, best known for Pogo, Eve Merriam, wrote many, many children's books, Lucille Clifton, like Langston Hughes, is probably best known for her poetry, but they wrote a great deal for children. So, yeah, I mean, part of the mission here, too, I think, is to show people another side of children's literature that maybe they just hadn't seen, even though these pretty well-known authors were out there and were producing literature for children on the left.
And Phil, among these well-known authors, did most of them identify strongly as leftists while they were writing, such that people who picked up their books would already know that these people had progressive or radical tendencies, or did they tend to write children's books without letting their audiences necessarily know about their politics?
Well, it depends on the author. And although the book is a collection of radical children's literature, that's what the subtitle is, truly, it represents a range on the left, from the merely liberal to the progressive to the truly radical. So there is actually a range of levels of left commitment in here. But, yeah, as I say, I mean, it depends on the author. Sid Hoff, for example, concealed his left politics. He didn't want those to get out. And Sid Hoff is best known to readers of children's literature as the author of Danny and the Dinosaur, but he also did New Yorker cartoons for many years. And he kept his other radical side of his persona fairly quiet. On the other hand, Dr. Seuss, who I would call more of a progressive, I wouldn't really call him a radical, he was really quite open about his political convictions and wrote a number of very popular activist children's books, like The Sneetches or Yertle the Turtle or The Butter Battle Book. So it depends on the writer.
Well, you're an expert on Dr. Seuss, Phil. You've written books about Dr. Seuss and his work. Let's talk about The Sneetches, which is the story of Dr. Seuss that's featured in this book. It was published in Red Book magazine, I guess, in 1953. It later came out as a book, and you've chosen to include the version that was the earlier version, published in 1953. Can you start off by reading that story for us?
Sure. If you go to Oahu and walk down the beach, you'll notice a sort of a bird called the sneetch. In fact, there are two sorts of sneetches you'll find, the star-belly kind and the plain-belly kind. The star-belly sneetches have bellies with stars. The plain-belly sneetches don't have them on theirs. Now, those stars, they're not big. They're really so small, you'd think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because of their stars, all the star-belly sneetches believe they're the best kind of sneetch on the beaches. Won't talk to the others. They pass them right by with their snoots high and mighty stuck up in the sky. Won't ask them to go to their parties or sleigh rides, their ball games, their marshmallow roast, or their hay rides. And the plain-belly sneetches, well, they get so mad that they sometimes do things that are really quite bad. They throw dreadful things at the star-bellies' heads, like oysters and clams and the springs of old beds. How they fight on those beaches, those unfriendly sneetches. And all because sneetches, whose bellies have stars, think they're better than sneetches with none upon theirs. And really, it's sort of a terrible shame, for except for those stars, every Sneetch is the same.
That is The Sneetches by Dr. Seuss, as published in Red Book in 1953.
The early version.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's interesting because he wrote it. It was inspired by his opposition to anti-Semitism. And this early draft, you know, gets that across, although in the final draft he has a much stronger message at the end, because the Sneetches actually learn that they're all the same, that they're all equal. And the version from 61 has, Sneetches are Sneetches, and no kind of Sneetch is the best on the beaches, and they recognize this. In this earlier version, the reader can see that, but the Sneetches haven't quite learned it yet.
What early experiences of Seuss generated in him an empathy for victims of bigotry?
Well, Seuss grew up in Massachusetts, and he was entering his teenage years during the First World War. And he was picked on for being a German-American. He recalls being chased home from school by kids with brickbats who shouted, "Kill the Kaiser." And then when he went to college, he went to Dartmouth College, nobody asked him to pledge a fraternity because with his long nose and dark hair, they thought he was Jewish. He wasn't Jewish, but this perceived religion and his perceived ethnic origins caused people to pick on him. And so I think from an early age, he kind of developed a sympathy for the underdog. And then in the Second World War, when he began writing propaganda cartoons, first for PM and then actually creating for the U.S. government, that's when he begins to wear his political convictions on his sleeve. And then after the war, you start to see this entering his children's books like The Sneetches.
Philip Nell, co-editor with Julia Mickenberg of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. We have a link to that on againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Julia, some interesting, many interesting stories about the field of children's literature as it developed. When juvenile publishing began to develop as its own separate division of the book industry in the 1920s, what kinds of people led the field, and what impact did that have on the dissemination of unconventional ideas?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is something that I think I talked about more in my first book, but the field of juvenile publishing was almost completely dominated by women, particularly at the at an editorial level. And the first juvenile divisions in publishing houses were only established in the 1920s. And most of these women were, all these women were educated women, and this was at a time when only in the last, prior 30 years or so were women able to get advanced degrees. And these tended to be independent-minded, not just educated, but often single, and often, politically progressive, not necessarily radical women, but in a kind of progressive social welfare sort of milieu. And they tended to be very open-minded. So, for example, a woman by the name of Ernestine Evans had been a foreign correspondent. She had covered, I don't know if it was the Russian Revolution, but she had been a foreign correspondent in the Soviet Union, was pretty radical herself. And she was a juvenile editor at Coward McCann. That's not right. I'm forgetting the name of the publishing house. Anyway, she discovered the author Wanda Gog, who at that time was a political cartoonist for the New Masses and is, probably most known now for her Millions of Cats. But she is another example of a writer who, a writer and artist who kind of got her start in the radical publications. And I think she had done an art exhibit at a left-wing gallery that Evans had attended and encouraged her to do work in children's literature. And this was it was a milieu that was, I think, that was open-minded and friendly to progressive politics. At the same time, there is also this expectation of a kind of conservative orientation, I think, in children's literature. This this idea that politics has no place in children's literature, and there was certainly a segment of the early children's book publishing industry that Well, in the early industry, there was kind of a tension between librarians who really favored imaginative literature and then progressive educators who wanted to teach children about the way the world works. And there was a kind of segment of children's literature that was tied to progressive education. That tended to represent people on a more left-wing spectrum. So there was an early tension between those who felt that children should be taught something about the way the world works and children and people who felt that that was inappropriate for the young, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. There was a lot of tension, Julia, generated by the McCarthy era. And with all that clamping down on dissent, what are we to understand about children's books during this time and the significance of that period to radical writers?
That was the thing that kind of got me interested in writing the first book, was that I learned that a number of blacklisted people were able to publish children's books, to write or actually to work in the children's literature field as editors. And this seemed really counterintuitive to me, because I knew that during the McCarthy period there was not just anxiety about radicalism, but a lot of anxiety about children and being corrupted by radicals. A lot of public school teachers were fired. And so I started trying to look at, you know, why this is happening. Because the children's literature field was so dominated by women and geared toward children, I think it was never deemed really important enough to investigate. And so in many ways, it actually became a real safe haven for many radicals. So, for instance, a number of fired teachers moved into writing children's books. This was especially the case for a number of science and math teachers who lost their jobs and became kind of the major writers of scientific children's literature, which we can, you know, maybe talk about later, because that seems like a realm that couldn't be political at all. That also speaks to another point and a kind of distinction between the work that I was doing on my first book and what Phil and I were looking at in this book, which is that people who are radical writers don't necessarily write radical books, and that's particularly true for children's literature. Somebody like Sid Hoff is a great example. I spent a long time trying to figure out what was radical about Danny and the Dinosaur, and if any of your listeners have an opinion on that, I think we'd love to hear it. I don't see anything in there. But he, you know, wrote under the name A. Redfield and was an art editor in his radical children's books, and he was an art editor and also published some cartoons under A. Redfield, was an art editor on the Communist Children's Magazine, The New Pioneer. And other people have a kind of more very subtle politics in their work. I think one of the important, one of the major contributions of radicals during the McCarthy period was to create books that represented American racial diversity, and in ways that were often very, very subtle but quite important. A good example is a book called Two is a Team by Gerald and Lorraine Baim, that was published in 1945, I believe. And it's a very simple story for young children that shows a black child and a white child who are best friends. And that was a very radical statement. And you see something similar, I think, happening in Langston Hughes's first book of Negroes, and we included an excerpt from that story. I don't know how long you want me to go on in the answer, but there's an interesting story around the dynamics, the ways in which the dynamics of McCarthyism played into the publication of that story.
Can you either read or synopsize a portion of this story by Langston Hughes? It's entitled A Little Boy in a Big City, and it's part of this first book of Negroes.
Sure. I'll say the little bit of the background of how McCarthyism figured into that is that when this book came out, this book was published in 1952. At this time, Hughes, who had a number of radical associations, particularly the 1930s, was being called before various investigating committees for his politics. And he was having trouble getting his work published and was kind of in the midst of trying to tone down his politics to show he wasn't very radical. Two other writers, Franklin Folsom and Mary Elting Folsom, had written many of books for Franklin Watts, the publisher. They did the first books, the real books, these different nonfiction series, and they accused Franklin Watts of being racist because he didn't include any stories about or by African Americans. And Franklin Watts said, no, of course I'm not racist. You find me a black writer, and I'll do a first book of Negroes. So they knew Hughes from the, you know, sort of left-wing community. They recommended him. And I found an interesting dynamic in the archive where Hughes had his initial draft, and both the Mary Folsom and Franklin Watts and his wife, Helen Hoke Watts, who was an editor there, kept trying to encourage him to make the story more explicit about segregation in the South. And so this is the, I'll read a little piece from here. If Terry lived in the South where his great-grandfather was once a slave, he could not go into a downtown theater or restaurant, since it is against the law in Southern cities for colored people to sit next to white people or to eat with them in public. Negroes must ride on the back seats of buses and streetcars, and they must sit in a separate train coach unless they are rich enough to afford a Pullman. Remember, this is 1952. This is legal segregation, but Negroes call it Jim Crow, and they do not believe it is legal because it does not follow our Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, which says all men are free and equal. And it also shows this little boy, Terry, who is African-American. He's from an educated family, and it shows him having a good friend who's white. Again, this was really radical to do something like this in the early 50s.
Julian Mickenberg, co-editor with Philip Nell of the book Tales for Little Rebels. We have a link on againstthegrain.org to this book, which collects 44 tales and texts for children written by all kinds of people in the 20th century, with a great deal of historical, political, social context written in the editor's introductions to the various sections. I want to get, Phil Nell, I want to get to a tale entitled X, A Fabulous Child Story, which features a baby that, as you write, challenges the construct of gender in the 1970s. Who wrote this story, and when was it published, and how ahead of its time was it?
Yeah, this is one of the most radical pieces in the book, I think. It was written by Lois Gould, who is really not known for writing for children, not at all. She did the New York Times Hers column. She was an editor at Ladies' Home Journal and McCall's. Also, a memoir of hers was made into a film in the early 70s. But this story for children that she wrote was first published in 1972 in Ms. Magazine's Stories for Free Children section, and then later revised slightly and published as a picture book in 1978. And it is indeed about a baby named X. It begins this way. Once upon a time, a baby named X was born. This baby was named X so that nobody could tell whether it was a boy or a girl. Its parents could, of course, but they couldn't tell anybody else. They couldn't even tell baby X, at least not until much, much later. You see, it was part of a very important secret scientific experiment known officially as Project Baby X. And the story goes on to tell us about how the scientists have to find parents who are willing to raise this child without reference to gender, raise a gender-neutral child, and they eventually find the Jones family who are willing to raise the child that way. But, of course, the Jones run into problems because the world is organized around gender. You know, they want to buy toys for baby X, and they want to buy clothes for baby X, but these are segregated into boys' pajamas and girls' underwear and boys' fire engines and girls' housekeeping sets. Fortunately, however, the scientists have given them an official instruction manual that anticipates all these kinds of problems, and the manual says just buy some of everything. And so they do. And so baby X grows up pretty well and learns to play with all different kinds of toys, irrespective of its gender. And this works out really well until baby X goes to school. Because when baby X goes to school, the other children expect to know whether baby X is a boy or is a girl. And baby X's behavior confuses them. And so they, for example, baby X asks the girls if they'd like to shoot some baskets, and they make faces at this, and ask the boys if they'd like to do basket weaving, and the boys are weirded out by that as well, and make fun of Baby X. And so this is very sad for Baby X. But fortunately, the Baby X parents are supportive, and Baby X keeps doing its own thing, and then gradually the kids come around. As one of the kids observes, X thinks it's fun playing boy stuff and girl stuff, and another of the kids says, come to think of it, Baby X is having twice as much fun as we are. And then all the kids want to be like Baby X. And so they all start dressing in overalls, which is what Baby X wears, which is a great choice, if you think about it, because a child in overalls, you can't tell what gender it is. It's just a child in overalls. And then, so they do. And suddenly, you know, Susie doesn't want to wear pink dresses anymore. She wants to wear overalls. And then Jim, the class football nut, starts wheeling his football helmet around in a doll carriage. And the parents, of course, freak out. You know, they think Baby X is a bad influence. They think Baby X is abnormal. And they raise a ruckus. The kids are happy, but the parents aren't. And so they call in the experts to evaluate Baby X. And the experts determine that X is, quote, just about the least mixed-up child we've ever examined. And so they have to keep X in school, and all the kids get to play their gender-neutral games and just, you know, do whatever they want, whether it's a stereotypically boy thing or a girl thing. And the message of the story is that we should not be confined by gender. We should be allowed to do what we want, lead the kind of life that we want, irrespective of what is more masculine or more feminine. And they do, and that's the story. And it's a wonderful piece, and I hope it teaches a new generation of readers about gender and about you know, being themselves.
How was the story received in the 1970s?
Well, some people were some people found it a little strange. I mean, there was one review in particular that said, let me see if I can find it here. Said that it evoked, quote, genital mutilation anxiety. because, you know, we don't know what the kid's gender is. We don't know what the kid's sex is, really, for the book. And so there were some people who were a little worried that this was too radical. But it's also a book that, when I've mentioned it to other people, seemed to really resonate with them as the first book of its kind that they'd seen. I think it speaks not just to gender, but to sexuality too, to kids who, you know, understood that they weren't quite identifying with what was heteronormative, you know, what was appropriately heteronormative, masculine or feminine, as well. So it's a wonderful story, and as I say, I hope people enjoy it.
Phil, this story appeared in a magazine in 1978, and many of the stories you've collected originally appeared in movement periodicals. Can you tell us a little bit about the landscape of these periodicals, some of the names, and which radical organizations they might have been associated with?
Well, sure. I mean, I think Julia would be just as good, if not better, on this question than I am. Do you want to feel that one, Julia?
Sure.
Or do you want me to field it?
I'm happy to field it. There are, you know, a range of them. There, we tried to not have just things that were associated with those, you know, closely tied to the movements. But there's the Little Socialist magazine for boys and girls. I don't know if we have a piece from there. There's the New Pioneer, which was published by the Communist Party. We have several pieces from there. There's, of course, Ms. Magazine, as you mentioned. There's a radical black newspaper called Freedom, which had a special children's section. The Daily Worker had often comic strips and other special sections for kids. The New Masses, I don't think they had pieces for kids, but they had recommended children's books, which is the way we found some of those things. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, originally published Julius Lester's Black Folk Tales, which we included. Some of these movements had their own publishing houses. So, for example, Second Wave Feminists had something called the Lollipop Power Press, which was, I suppose, a kind of the feminist press still exists, but the Lollipop Power Press was specifically for children. There were a lot of these. There were quite a few during the 1930s and 1940s. Fraternal Outlook had children's pages. So many of these either had special special periodicals for children, or they might have children's pages within the other journals. International publishers, the Communist Party Publishing House, had a special juvenile series called Young World Books. And I think many librarians either didn't make the connection or didn't care that it was a Communist Publishing House, because you can find many of the Young World books in libraries still, and some of them were actually reprinted by regular trade publishers.
Julia Mickenberg and Philip Nell have co-edited a new book published by NYU Press. It's entitled Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. Julia is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And when she talks about her other book, it's entitled Learning from the Left, Children's Literature, the Cold War, and Radical Politics in the U.S. Philip Nell is a professor of English at Kansas State University, and he's author of books like Dr. Seuss, American Icon, and The Annotated Cat, Under the Hats of Seuss and His Cats.